And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, Patty Quatro, I don't know about you, but I loved taking a deep dive into the Pleasure Seekers' first three singles off of Mercury Records in April 1968. And I have to tell you, I don't know if I want to kill you or hug you. I'm not complaining, but I have had your three singles stuck in my head on loop. That's it. They're all turntable hits to me. I know Light of Love was the one, but the three of them really, I've said this before, it really shows your variety as a band, and it was just so much fun to hear all the insider details. So tell us anything you want to follow up with.
Well, it was really surprising what went into these trial DJ episodes to get the feedback they wanted. We had no idea. We learned a lot through that crazy week of promo copies and all that shit, you know.
And how important data is when those plays are playing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we teased on the last episode about the Pleasure Seekers' upcoming Northwest tour that would gain you such national prominence for the band that it is just, again, I am going to overuse a word probably till the end of the season. This is just mind-blowing to me, and I cannot wait for the listeners to hear this. So we are going to get into the details of how this Northwest tour came about, including Pat O'Day that we talked about on the previous episode. And you said Pat O'Day was a concert promoter, kind of akin to Bill Graham. And you said he was huge, huge, huge. But before we even get to Pat O'Day, there's one facet of the Pleasure Seekers that we've talked about before, but I really now want to emphasize it, which is the musicianship of all of you at this moment in time. Let's just remind everybody, Slingerland gives a sponsorship to Dar. Every time you are written about, your tightness as a band is being commented on from press, nightclub owners, fans, fellow musicians. And I therefore really think your extraordinary musicianship as a band is what we should talk about as we get to Pat O'Day in this Northwest tour, because he hears about you initially. He doesn't see you. It's hearsay. And
Right.
so I want to bring you in here and have you talk about anything and what you picked up on from the press and your fans about how tight you were as a band. And then I want to read a little bit before we get to Pat O'Day.
We were very, very blessed with the press as we were doing all of our journey, because they always seem to, pick up on the looks and then marry it up with the talent immediately. They weren't like gonna stick to that and demean it in any way. So, and the fans did the same thing when they would come up to us and said, "Oh my God, you play so good." And, I mean, it was just, we were motivated to be the best we could be and have the highest standard we could have as we kept escalating and learning more chops and stuff,
Well, I want to focus on that for one second, and then I want to read a little bit. But you wanted to be the best band ever. Was that because you were an all-girl band and had something to prove? I'm
No.
just curious because, I mean, you set a very high bar musically for yourselves. Now,
We
that's your family background too, but I'm just curious if gender came into any of it.
no, not at that point. No, we didn't compare ourselves to other girl groups or the male bands. We just wanted to be in the bag that we were in and play a variety of music, and that was it. We weren't doing gender. We weren't. We just didn't believe in it. We didn't want to depend on that. So no, we didn't.
Well, it's interesting because I recently had a text exchange with one of your former bandmates, Pammy and the Bird Benford, who was your rhythm and sometimes bass guitarist. And she said something very similar, and I wanted to read it to you and get your thoughts on it, Patty. So Pammy says, quote, "I think the one thing we were very proud of was that we relied on our musical talents. Without question, we played our way. We never really identified musically as a girl band. More than once, people came to see the girl band, but they always came back to see the good band. It was not our goal, at least not mine, and I think the others would agree, to knock down doors, but we certainly knocked down more than our share of them." So, Patty, I'm curious, do you agree with Pammy's assessments?
I totally agree with her. I think it was because we never cut slack with ourselves, thinking that because we were women, we would have an easier time of it or use our sexuality. That wasn't our motivation. And I think the press and the fans picked up on that. It's just the way it went. I totally agree with her.
Well, and I want to remind the listeners that we did read from one Cashbox article, which is an insider music magazine. But this writer clearly picked up on this. And I want to read it again in this context. So this is after seeing you at Arthur, the discotheque in New York. And this is in April 1968. And it says, quote, "The pleasure seekers are beautiful, both musically and physically. If they didn't have any talent, they could work dates on the strength of their looks alone. But they do have talent. In fact, they play and sing with more power than most of the new male groups. All girl groups have appeared on the scene before, but none have appeared on the scene that have made this kind of lasting impact. Most of them lack a solid musical base. The pleasure seekers have such a base, and given the right materials, they could go all the way." Close quote. And so I want to keep going with this. Billboard magazine on April 27th, 1968. So all at the same time now, the headline reads, "The pleasure seekers know how to rock it and sock it to 'em." Close quote. And the opening line, also in New York, reads, "The pleasure seekers, a five-girl rock group, displayed driving vocal and instrumental ability at Arthur on April 12th, near the end of their 2-week stint at the East Side Discotheque." Close quote. And from Record World, another music insider mag, this is also April 27th, 1968. It reads about the pleasure seekers on Mercury Records, quote, "These five girls lay down hard rock sounds quite well. Reaction should be highly favorable." Close quote. And I do have one more from you. This is Record World, also May 4th, 1968. And this was written by a woman, Carol Corson. And she writes in part, quote, New York, a new Mercury group, the Pleasure Seekers, kept things moving at Arthur recently to the delight of everyone. The five gorgeous girls displayed an energy and versatility uncommon in most groups today, either male or female. Not satisfied to get by on their looks, the group worked through their sets with a professionalism usually seen only with established groups, holding the pace and excitement at a high level. Close quote. And Patty, this was consistent. And they really did focus on, yes, you were gorgeous, but I love that idea of you were gorgeous musically too. And so I just want you to reply to any of this. I know you said that you always got great press, but was there ever a moment where you didn't get this reaction? Because this seems to be incredibly universal, this feedback.
Well, there might have been some odd comment now and then in some kind of press that maybe we were too loud or something. Who knows? But no, this was the norm for the band. We were very blessed with our press all the way through many years. And we were lucky and driven to keep up the reputation. You know, we were lucky with bands telling us that we played better than many of the bands they played with. Leslie West said that all the time. The MC5, Alice Cooper. They always made that comment. So it wasn't just the press saying it. And we were, you know, you hit on a word there when the girl writer said versatility, and that struck me because it was our vision and our upbringing to hit many genres in our sets, and many other bands would stay moored in a certain bag that they were in, not us. We loved doing it all. And I think that served us really well in developing a sound that the fans dug hearing, this versatility thing.
Well, and also you were gorgeous. So they got to have eye candy and they got to have ear candy all at the same time. Well, it's just so much fun to read and to be kind of a fly on the wall thinking about what this was like for you. I mean, the buzz was out there. Your reputation, as you said, was starting to precede you. You had to be good live in those days. You could not be. I think you would have been written off very quickly as a girl band. I'm sorry. Even if you didn't see yourselves as a girl band, the male suits would have seen you that way. And we will talk a little bit about that. But I also now want to talk about how your explosive reputation was becoming so big, and so much so that Mercury Records was continuing to back you financially. They were very, very supportive of you because of the response of the singles. So we mentioned, just a little tease, and I want to hear anything you want to say about it, Patty, that Mercury Records, you're now back home for a few days in Detroit and at the very famous, legendary Rooster Tail nightclub. Mercury Records throws a party for the pleasure seekers there to play all of your singles that have been released. So tell us anything about that memorable evening.
Oh, that was a wonderful party they threw. And Dick Corby, our producer, came in for it, and some other of the suits. I can't remember their names. And I even think we had some of the local bands come. I mean, it was a fun party. We played upstairs, which was the hip room. And I don't even remember if we played like a set or just did the singles or whether they just played them on the PA thing, but we had a great time and it was very cool that they did that for us because they didn't always do that with bands throwing a press party. It didn't always happen back then.
No, it really didn't. And that's what I mean about you can feel and see that the financial support was there, that this just was not kind of talking out of their mouths, but not providing for you. So something else I want you to talk about, Patty, because geographically and logistically, and we've said this before, Canada is right across the Detroit River if you're here in Detroit. And so you did go back and forth to Canada a lot, and you played a lot of gigs, the Pleasure Seekers. And so I now want to talk about, if you can imagine, we're still at the end of April 1968. So much is going on. And now the Pleasure Seekers go over to Canada, to Windsor, and then to London, Ontario. And I want you to tell us about these gigs in Canada, but also you and I have talked privately about this because I think it's fascinating, is the music scene in Canada. It was really cool and hip. So tell us anything you remember about these gigs.
Well, the gigs were great. We did Windsor and then we did Campbell's, where we took a bunch of new pictures in our own clothing, which was fun, just having fun. And then we went to Toronto and that blew our minds. It was such a lively, vibrant music scene. And it reminded us of our own hometown because they were so into the music. It was a cool, hip city, and we loved playing there. A lot of clubs, and the Hawk's Nest was a very popular club, and it was a very high energy atmosphere there. Steppenwolf played there, the Kinks played there, and a lot of other notables. It was a mix of local and known bands, and Yonge Street was known to be the street that everything was happening on. It was very cool. And we'd already played Windsor with Ike and Tina and Sam the Sham, but now we're traveling more and going to more cities in Canada and opening up that feeling of another country to get our escalation in not only the States, but Canada. And Toronto was it.
How was your fan base there? Did they love you?
Yes, we played so many times in Toronto, many different gigs there through the years,
So
all the time.
you were
Oh,
quite
yeah.
popular. Well, you said Yonge Street in Toronto, am I getting that correct? Was a lot like your hometown. So I just want to tease that out a little bit. Do you mean Detroit's Plum Street, that is the art community of the time, which I think you told me in season two, this was like the Haight-Ashbury of Detroit.
Yes, it was. It was very much. And everybody hung out there. It was such an artistic community. And Yonge Street felt the same way. They had all those little stores and stuff. It was just a very cool area. And it was always packed with kids and everything. It was wonderful.
Well, I just love that. And I believe your sister Arlene said in that My Son interview that we read when you were in Miami that she used to go to Plum Street and buy all of her rings there. So I
Yeah.
just think that's just wonderful. Well, sadly, like so many other places, Plum Street is no longer, well, Plum Street is still there, but the art community. And it's now a very large casino, but it sure had its moment, and so many people think about it. And so, also during this time, Patty, you and I have been talking about the pleasure seekers and this interesting relationship, even if it's kind of from afar, with the mob in the music industry. And we've told a couple of harrowing tales so far, but the stories continue. And I want you to just share briefly about this because I laughed out loud. So, as a reminder, Joe Glazier from ABC Booking, who is handling you, was a former mobster in Chicago before going into the music biz and getting out of the mob biz. Probably not, but pretending to. And you mentioned to me that the mafia wanted to buy the pleasure seekers for $1 million. I feel like this is $1 million. Tell us about this.
Well, to correct, Joe wasn't in the mafia, but he had all his friends were in the mafia. He grew up with them and stuff. One of his friends was Bugsy Siegel. I mean, you remember that name, geez. And the mafia people did in Toronto. And I don't know if it was a different mafia there, but they offered to buy the band for $1 million. We, of course, turned it down flat. It was ridiculous. But this was the start of the band coming to realize the different visions that some of these people had, with this bromance between music and mafia. And this included Mercury, ABC, and even the mafia. It was like a slow burn coming of age, how this music stuff worked with the radio, the DJs, the suits, and all of it, including the mafia.
Well, hold on, Patty, because I want to clarify something. This is the Toronto Mafia?
Yes. Well, a Canadian they were from. I don't know who they approached, Leo, or whether it came from Joe, but I mean, we weren't interested in that. We weren't going to have somebody own us. It was
I just
ridiculous.
no, I just didn't realize they were. It was the Canadians, the Mafia.
Yeah, Canadians.
Now, I'm going to call you out on something here because we have you on record in a previous episode telling us that Joe Glazier did have some mob connections. Now, whether he
Oh, he
legit,
did.
yeah. So, I mean, how do you disconnect that from, oh, he wasn't a mob, but he had all these mob connections, so.
No, he wasn't an actual mobster. I don't think he was ever that. I don't believe that was part of his history. But he went to school with them, he hung with them. I think he was just involved, so he had those connections and he used them when he went into music. I think that's the reality of it.
Got it. Okay.
I don't think he went around killing people and doing stuff. The, you know.
No,
Oh, that wasn't Joe.
I was going to say, and there's a hierarchy. You have other people to do that
Oh my God.
for you. So I want to pick up on something you just said in all seriousness. You said that the male suits, this showed you now that these, their vision for you, and we're not necessarily talking Mercury right now, but we will be talking about Mercury's vision for you. So tell us a little bit more about how this clash was going on or starting to happen with how the male suit saw the pleasure seekers versus your vision of the band.
Yeah, well, it was pretty obvious. You had this new world of women musicians entering the fray of rock music, and they all of them seemed to, as we came to believe, they wanted Las Vegas beauties in lavish costumes, wowing crowds with tinkling arrangements of happy tunes. Picture Donna Reed the musical. I mean, up until now, it had been the Motown vocal groups and stuff, and that's what they were used to. So they were still playing catch up. Okay, how do we market this? How do we get the most out of it? In fact, in a short time, this is hilarious, ABC ended up signing a topless female act for Las Vegas. So they got their TNA idea that way, because we sure weren't going down that avenue. And they're pretty lame, but I mean, whatever.
Oh, that just makes me laugh. That could be a whole different episode. Let's just let that
Oh my God.
My brain is just spinning right now on that one. I have too many questions. So, one of the things that you had said on the last episode when we were talking about this Northwest tour, you had mentioned to me, and I believe in the episode, so forgive me if we're repeating ourselves here, but that you were booked on a Far East tour. You were, this was for the Vietnam War. This is 1968, which also now speaks to and talks about your popularity, the buzz that was happening, because that's a huge investment for to send any kind of civilian overseas, let alone women. So tell us about how this booking happened, and then I want to now hear from you why you decided to postpone going to the Far East and go on a Northwest tour with Pat O'Day.
I would guess that that came through Mickey or directly to Leo. I mean, by this time we had business cards and the word of mouth was out all over, and they definitely wanted us and wanted to have a booking, and we couldn't do it because Pat O'Day made his offer. And it was so much more exciting. Not that we didn't want to, play for the troops and all that, but this was going to be in the Northwest for a younger crowd. It was more our style. And there was not even a question which offer we were going to take. So we just pushed that off to another time when we could book it and had time between this Northwest tour and other gigs.
So this Northwest tour that Pat O'Day put together, and I want you to tell us a little bit about Pat O'Day is, but before then, he was calling this a quote teen spectacular. And
Yes.
so when I realize that's an this is probably a very obvious question. Did he mean teen spectacular because it's teen bands? Was it for an audience of teens? I mean, you were still teenagers, or some of you were.
It was for, it drew from all around the states, and he put it on every year, the Teen Spectacular, and he booked a bunch of bands, and it drew younger crowd. Definitely drew that. So he kept doing it every year. It was a pretty amazing thing, 9 days long. So he had to sell a lot of tickets, but people kept coming and coming. So it was a huge event.
So tell us about Pat O'Day. I mean, he was so huge in rock and roll and what he did for so many bands. I think his significance cannot be overstated. So tell us about Pat O'Day.
He was an American broadcaster and concert promoter. His company was called Concerts West, and he was bigger than Bill Graham. I mean, he had a whole area that he did, many states. And he was known as the godfather of the teen dance scene. And it was a huge change for us to play in that younger arena, thanks to him. He opened so many dance clubs all over the state, 60 dances a week in the 60s. And then he shifted to concerts and he brought in the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. I mean, so many notables, So he was known as a national concert promotional powerhouse. He was also a radio and on radio and a DJ. And he even was GM at one of the studios he worked at. So he had his fingers in a lot of pies. And very well known and has a big legacy up there.
Incredible. And I want to add to his incredible legacy that he saw the talents, not only physically, but musically, of the pleasure seekers. And so there's this Pat O'Day press release.
Oh my God.
And I'm just going to let the listeners know that we are going to be reading it in full because it is that good. It is that impressive. And I want to hear from you, Patty, but I'm just going to start and we're going to take it from here because now this is again Pat O'Day. He didn't, well, I'm just going to let him say it. Let's just let his words say it. So this is from Pat O'Day. Quote, "Pleasure Seekers smash in Northwest tour late in May of 1968. Pleasure Seekers Productions received a phone call from Pat O'Day and Associates in Seattle. He was interested in booking the Pleasure Seekers for a teen spectacular he was putting on for, as you said, Patty, 9 days in Seattle." It goes on to read, "Mr. O'Day said his associates had been searching the United States for 6 months, trying to find a female act to highlight this teen spectacular. His most trusted and respected contacts had repeatedly told him," and here's what I mean about your reputation, Patty, "you want the pleasure seekers." And somebody else said, "The pleasure seekers are everything you want and more. They are the only girl group that can do the job right." So negotiations were made, and the girls found themselves in Seattle early in June. So, Patty, I do want to keep reading this, but I need to stop here because this is such a big deal for the band. Pat O'Day was so big at this time. This was going to change your paradigm as a rock and roll group. And so tell us a little bit about what you were thinking as you were heading over to Seattle.
Well, Mickey knew his reputation because he was also starting into the festivals and all that, promoting in the Midwest. We were flabbergasted at how excited they were to get us booked for this teen spectacular. They were pretty damn firm about it. And Mickey was like, "Oh God, yeah, we got to do this." He knew. He knew. So, we didn't even think twice. We were going to Seattle.
Well, and again, this is they had Pat O'Day and his associates hadn't even seen you. This was all outside contact saying, "You have to get the pleasure seekers. You have to." So it goes on to read, quote, "Opening day found the pleasure seekers sharing the bill with the five Americans and Boyce and Hart. No one in Seattle knew what to expect of these five young girls. Pat O'Day certainly did not expect to see such a fantastic act, as he was to admit several times while the pleasure seekers were there. As he put it so well after the girls left the stage that first day, Pat O'Day says, 'I don't believe it. I just don't believe it.'" Pat O'Day was at a loss for words for the first time in his life.
I love that.
And the presser goes on to read, quote, "The second day, word had gotten around already. Enormous crowds had gathered by showtime. Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, the stars of the show, were 20 minutes late for their own show because they were watching the pleasure seekers perform and taking movies of them. They too said they couldn't believe how heavy these girls were." I mean, Patty, I'm just in awe. This is amazing. I would give anything to have these home movies from Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, no less. Do you remember any of this? Do you remember being filmed by them? They were in the wings, but.
I remember being filmed, and I would have killed to get a hold of those. I tried to contact them or their wives, and, "Do you have this in your attic?" But, it was never found. But I remember them standing there with Pat, and oh, it was unbelievable. The staging was beautiful, had a big balloon behind us, and, we were focused on doing our show. But yeah, it was pretty amazing. I do remember them filming.
That's incredible. And we have photos from those sets, so we will
Oh, God, yes.
be sharing them. So the presser goes on to read, quote, "By the fourth days, boys were fighting the girls for the front row seats to see these five girls who generated enough excitement to carry the whole show. Pat O'Day was getting more excited about the group each day. On the seventh day, the pleasure seekers found themselves headlining the show above such acts as Canned Heat, The Fever Tree, and The Five Americans. His introduction to the group went like this." So this is Pat O'Day. "When I brought this group to Seattle, I had not heard them myself. I hired them on hearsay. I heard they were fantastic. I didn't expect them to be as phenomenal as they are. If I would have known how fantastic they were, I would have promoted them far better than I did. They have been the biggest draw of the teen spectacular and the highlight of the entire fair. These girls excel in everything. Their combination of musicianship and showmanship makes one of the best acts I have ever seen in my life. Close quote. So take that in for a moment, Patty, from Pat O'Day. He's talking about you and the band you founded, the Pleasure Seekers, only a few years back in '64. Now you have your own screaming teen fans instead of watching teen fans scream at a Beatles concert. What were you thinking?
Oh, you know what? The huge energy in the rooms was palpable to the max from the fans. It was amazing, really. It was our first experience with that kind of a major crowd response. And we were gobsmacked at this huge promoter being so vocal in the press and on mic and on PR to anyone that would listen. It was unbelievable.
Well, this is an ongoing theme with the Pleasure Seekers, and I think Pat O'Day fits right into this ongoing theme, which is yes, you're an all-girl band, and he acknowledges that, but the talent and musicianship supersedes that so quickly. It's he's not saying, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe how good they are for girls." That's not what
No,
he's saying.
never,
He's saying
never.
this is one of the best acts I have ever seen in my life, which is staggering. I'm at a loss for words. So the presser continues, if you can believe this. It reads, quote, "Now I know when they begin to play, you will be shocked and stunned with surprise," Pat O'Day goes on. "So please, right now, give them the welcome they deserve." And then it concludes with, quote, "The Pleasure Seekers," this makes me so emotional, "The Pleasure Seekers walked on stage to a 5-minute standing ovation. Following the teen spectacular, Eric Burdon and the Animals came to the Northwest. Pat O'Day insisted that the Pleasure Seekers play the concerts with them. As one Spokane newspaper put it, the Pleasure Seekers were such a smash success. After their performance, the rest of the show was anticlimactic." Close quote. So, Patty, do you remember this 5-minute standing ovation and what that was like for you? Did you let yourself just take that in?
Oh, yes, we did. The whole thing was a magic pill. We had cool costuming, and the photos are great. You have them to use. And the response floored us. Getting that by being in a band that wasn't international yet, how could you not remember those 9 days of magic? And it just kept escalating.
It really did. I have more to read from the presser. It says, quote, "What had started as a 9-day engagement turned into a fantastic 3-month tour of the Northwest. Pat O'Day's offer was so great that the Pleasure Seekers had to postpone a Far Eastern tour in order to fill the demands for them to stay in the Northwest area. The girls played to record-breaking crowds, excuse me, everywhere they went. If this Northwest tour was any indication of the Pleasure Seekers' potential, they are certainly destined to be one of the supergroups on the pop music scene of today." Close quote.
Unbelievable.
Patty, please reflect on any and all of this for us.
It was, oh my God. There's so much to unpack too as we go forward of doing that tour because we were held over for 3 months, the whole summer, and put in an apartment. We had been in a hotel and then we were in an apartment. And it was no doubt the highest tour we had ever played up to this point. And there's a TV video show to come. We actually have one. Crazy fun, dramatic and humorous interactions with other bands. The Eric Burdon tour, where we did something pretty blasphemous
Yes.
in a tune that we did on that tour.
Ooh.
Outrageous, new controversial costuming. Oh, that's going to be fun. And we were held over. I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing. There is so much to come on this visionary Pat O'Day as we hitched our wagon to his promotional advice and his ideas for what should be next for us as we started adjusting some of our new moves and visions while we still held to our ultimate visions on our journey and where we were going next. It was a challenge, and we had to meet the challenge because this was a whole new ball game at this point.
I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. But I'm so tired of crying. But I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. I ain't got no woman just to call my special friend. You know the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow. In the rain and snow. You know the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow. In the rain and snow. I didn't have no pharaoh, not even no place to go. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young. When I was quite young. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young. When I was quite young. She said, Lord, have mercy on my wicked son. From your mama, please, don't you cry no more, don't you cry no more. Take a hint from your mama, please, don't you cry no more, don't you cry no more. Cause it's soon one morning, down the road I'm gone. But I ain't going down that long old lonesome road all by myself. But I ain't going down there.